2 Peter 2, we're going to start in verse 4. And coming to him as to a living stone, which has been rejected by men, but is choice and precious in the sight of God, you also, as living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house for a royal, for a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. For this is contained in Scripture: Behold, I lay in Zion a choice stone, a precious cornerstone, and he who believes in him will not be disappointed. This precious value, then, is for you who believe. But for those who disbelieve, the stone which the builders rejected, this became the very cornerstone, and a stone of stumbling, and a rock of offense. For they stumble because they are disobedient to the word, and to this doom they were also appointed. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of the darkness into his marvelous light. For you once were not a people, but now you are the people of God. You had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the things in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. Persecution in reality is a part of Christianity, isn't it? At least it ought to be. Persecution ought not to be something that we find strange. As we said before, what ought to be strange is if we find ourselves not persecuted. If we find ourselves serving God without any persecution whatsoever, we probably have accepted some watered-down version of Christianity rather than the real thing. Suffering and being a disciple of Christ go together. In the last few lectures and studies, we've been talking about the Christians receiving this letter. They themselves are being persecuted. They themselves are suffering greatly. And Peter writes to them to encourage them, to remind them that they need to hold on. Because what they have started needs to be finished. What they have started is worth finishing. What they have in Jesus Christ is worth holding on to. So Peter writes to them, encouraging them. We saw in chapter 1, verses 1 through 13, he encourages them about the salvation that we have. It is rich. It is secure. It compares to nothing this world can offer us. Whereas this world can only offer benefits that last for a short time, God's blessings, God's promises are forever. We have a living hope that's based on a living Messiah, a resurrected Christ. In verses 14 through chapter 2 and verse 3, we talked about having a new way of life. Yes, before you were a Christian, maybe you didn't have to suffer as much, but look at how you lived. Look at the blessing that we have now and being lifted up out of all of this. You've been called to a new way of life, a different conduct, different principles, different family, a different identity. Now you live a life of reverence, holiness, love, which makes everything in life so much more meaningful. While circumstances are different, I think the Peter uses a similar argument. He says, don't forget who you are in this next section. Don't forget who you are as Christians. Don't forget your role that God has given to you as a Christian. He talks about then, in this next section, he talks about our glorious purpose in Christ Jesus, our glorious purpose. And so what he's going to go about doing is talk about us as living stones and that glorious purpose that we have. And I think in a nutshell, and trying to get our mind wrapped around this, maybe he's saying something like, you know, just remember who you are. Remember who you are as one of these living stones. Who are we as Christians? Verses 4 through 5 talk to us as living stones. We have come to Him to the living stone. And our identity is based on the identity and the example of Jesus Christ Himself. In verses 5 through 4, He says, coming to Him as to living stones, which has been rejected by men, but is choice and precious in the sight of God. You also, as living stones, are being built up in a spiritual house for a royal priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. There are several passages throughout the Scriptures that talked about Jesus as a stone or as a rock. The passages that Peter chooses to quote, one is from Isaiah chapter 28 and verse 16. In verse 6, he says, "For this is contained in Scripture, behold, I lay as in Zion a choice and precious cornerstone. He who believes in Him will not be disappointed." A chosen stone. And maybe that's a difficult idea for us in modern times. Especially, most of us are not really familiar with construction. And when we think, when even in modern times, a mason, maybe he does not go out into the forest to look for a stone that's going to be appropriate for his building. He orders it from a catalog and figures out exactly, oh, I want this stone because it has these exact characteristics. He doesn't have to search for it as much. But in this illustration, he talks about a stone that has been chosen for a particular purpose. Everything in the catalog is pre-shaped. Everything is identical. But I get the idea here is that this chosen stone is chosen for special purposes. And a special purpose it is. It would be the cornerstone of a great building. What's the idea of a cornerstone? What is the idea of a cornerstone?
Stone that everything else leans on and depends upon to remain sound, structurally intact.
Yeah. Sometimes a cornerstone is called, and especially in arches, is called a keystone. And you can think of that cornerstone, or that keystone, as all these other stones are leaning upon. And if you take that out, everything will crumble. When you build a building, however, a lot of times you'll have this cornerstone. Art?
I've done like cement block construction already, and what even though the particular stone my dad and I used was not anything special, we at least had one stone that was used to simply measure. We'd like to take a stake in where the stone is and then run a string on each way. That way we got the wall perfectly 90 degrees. We didn't get it, you know, 89 degrees or 91 degrees. So the stone, in our thinking, was a reference point. It was a standard. And so if Jesus is the chief cornerstone, He's our standard. And then the foundations, the apostles and prophets, because that's what the building rests on.
Right. And so just to get an idea, if you didn't hear this, this cornerstone would go in the corner then of the building. And then from that stone, even in modern times, or when I was in Guatemala, I saw a lot of this, where they wrap a string, a pita, right there. And you string it all the way out, and then all the other stones will come up and rest up against that string. You don't touch it. You get really close to it, but you're going to line up everything, not just this direction, but also this direction, and also up and down. And so everything is going to be balanced. You have to choose where are you going to put that stone. So it's a really interesting process, but the idea here is, of course, that Jesus, or what's the idea of Jesus being the cornerstone? What is that idea?
Standard of reference.
Okay, yeah. There's several passages that talk about Jesus as the foundation. There's one in Ephesians chapter 2. I think this is worth going and looking at that. Ephesians chapter 2, verses 19 through 22, that talk about Jesus as the foundational stone. Ephesians chapter 2. In verse 19, someone could read verses 19 through 22 for me.
So that you are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are fellow citizens with the saints and are members of the household of God, built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Christ Jesus Himself being the cornerstone.
Okay. All the way to verse 22. Okay.
In whom the whole structure being joined together grows into a holy temple in the Lord. In him you also are being built together into a dwelling place for God by the Spirit.
So in these verses, what is the cornerstone? Jesus Christ. Foundation is? The apostles sent out, prophets sent out by Christ. And then we are all placed and built up on top of everyone. So here's just an illustration. I think maybe this is not a difficult idea, but it's just an important idea. You have this cornerstone, and then everything is going to be angled upon this cornerstone. Everything's just that's where maybe it's not the exact strength of the building, but then it's where everything lines up. Same thing you have just this is an ancient building where you have everything's lined up. It's just this huge stone. It's chosen because of its shape. It's chosen because of its use. This is, you can't really see this, but many of you are familiar with the Symphonia CD, not advertising. I thought they were a really good illustration on the front of their cover. They have one of their CDs is called As Living Stones. As Living Stones, and really it's a reference to one of the songs that they sing, the particular song that we sang, Be Holy. And it talks about As Living Stones. What's interesting about the cover of this CD is that what it does is it takes each one of these stones is actually a picture of brethren somewhere in the United States. And so you look at it, and you can recognize some of the brethren that you know. It's a really neat idea that here's this building, and in what way is it built up? What's built on? Well, there's no picture of Jesus up there, of course. But the idea is here's this temple that's being built up with what? With individuals being stacked together, living stones. And what is the chief cornerstone? Well, Jesus Christ himself is that cornerstone. He is the foundational stone for Christianity and the church. It's amazing to see him as well as the chief cornerstone, not just for our living as Christians, but also just the chief cornerstone of just the entire Bible, the entire Bible message. When you read through the Old Testament, what is it that brings us to understanding what helps us to understand so many of those mysteries in the Old Testament? Well, it's pointing to Christ. It's pointing to that chief cornerstone, even from the Old Testament. It's the foundation. It's the missing piece of the entire Bible message. And finally, when you have Christ, everything makes sense. And finally, when we come to Christ, our lives now make sense because we have Jesus in our life. And then he builds this community of believers, the church, he being the chief cornerstone. So it's in a lot of ways, Peter is it describes Jesus as this chief cornerstone, and he fulfills that image. The chief cornerstone is used for that foundation. It is firmly placed, it is placed there by God himself. But Peter also talks about Jesus as a living stone. Interesting. What is the idea of a living stone in verse 4? Coming to him as a living stone. It's kind of an odd idea. If you think, take that literally, a living stone. It's even hard to think about. It would be a stone that's mushy or a stone that's a... No, it's, obviously it's not literal, but what is a living stone? What's the idea there? Tim?
The fact he's still active, still around today, in a sense. Obviously, when he died and he was raised from the dead, he didn't just stay in the grave and that's the end of... Yeah. You know, he's not a past kind of, he's still present, very much around, and very much in our lives.
Yeah, yeah. We saw a living hope earlier. We saw a living word earlier. And I think in both of those contexts, it's talking about something that lasts for a long time. It doesn't disappear. We have that he is a living stone. He is a living stone. He's something that is alive. He is resurrected. It's something that is active for you and for me. And you would think that being this living stone, this cornerstone that is so important for this building, wouldn't you think that everybody would appreciate this stone? But he's not just a living stone. He is what? He's also a rejected stone. He's a rejected stone. So it says in verse 4, he says, coming to him as a living stone which has been rejected by men. What is the idea there? Again, going back to a construction metaphor, where you have these builders who are going through and choosing their stones, their particular stones for their job. They find this stone. It's like, what are we going to use this for? And they throw it out. That was the stone. That was the stone that they needed. He was a rejected stone. One would think that that this stone that is so precious and necessary would be eagerly received by all. But then we remember how Jesus was received. He was rejected by men. There's a verse in Isaiah 53, verse 3. He was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And like one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. People rejected his message. People rejected his miracles. And this rejection culminated finally and then in his very death on the cross. In spite of the fact that he was the precious stone, he was the cornerstone. And so instead of a blessing, this stone became what? It became a curse. So in verse 6, you have a quotation from Isaiah 28. Behold, I lay in Zion a choice stone, a precious stone. He who believes in him will not be disappointed. It is a blessing. It should be a blessing for everyone who would come and accept him. But for those who reject, for those who disbelieve, in verse 7, the stone which the builders rejected, this became the very cornerstone and a stone of offense. And a stone, a rock, a stone of stumbling, and a rock of offense. He would be rejected by men. It also reminds me of Paul's words in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 22. You remember how Paul talks about the cross of Christ and how not many are going to be able to accept it. It says in 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and in verse 22. For indeed, Jews ask for signs, and Greeks search for wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, to Jews a stumbling block, and to Gentiles foolishness. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God, because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. Christ to the Jews is what? It's a stumbling block. To the Greeks, it is foolishness. But then to us as Christians, if we can recognize Him as that cornerstone, it is the power of God and it is the wisdom of God. We see the beauty in Jesus. And so therefore, although He is rejected, part of the important message of all of this is that while He is rejected by men, while man rejects the Christ, putting him to shame, and to everyone, it seemed like things were going badly for him, and it ended in death. His story ends in death. What did God do for him and do to him? In verse 4, it says, he was selected as what? He is the choice, and precious in the sight of whom?
God.
In God's sight. So I think this is important to see what's going on here. He talks about, and this is kind of not exactly boom, boom, boom in order of the verses, but thinking of this as Jesus, here is this living stone. He's being rejected by men. But then here comes God, and in all of His wisdom and all of His glory, He will come, and He will select this as a choice stone, as an accepted stone. The rejected stone became the very cornerstone. In verse 7, this stone which the builders rejected became the very cornerstone. God's plan, in other words, went on in spite of the rejection of man. He was rejected by man, but accepted by God. However, in all of this, what is Peter really driving at? While he does want us to meditate on Jesus, and what is it that Jesus did for us? His major purpose is to show us, really, who we are. He wants to show us how we have come to Him and what we have become as a result. Our purpose as a result. Verse 2 connects with the previous verses. And it starts off with, and coming to him as to a living stone. Really connecting back to these ideas of how we as individuals come seeking God, seeking him in reverence, seeking him in holiness, seeking him in love, seeking the Lord in his word. And because we have tasted the kindness of Jesus, since we are coming to him as a living stone, rejected by men but accepted by God, because we come to this stone that has been has had this role and purpose, look now at what role and purpose we have as Christians. Verse 5. Now you also, as living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house for a royal priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. That we too are what? That we're living stones being built up into this spiritual temple. Again, looking back at this idea of every single one of these stones is one of those Christians. Every single one of these stones, if this is the temple of the Lord, here's Jesus, the cornerstone, the foundation, the apostles. But now, the Lord uses each one of us in this great construction as he builds his temple, the temple of the Lord, and we become this spiritual house. What a strange image. Some people are just not going to understand this image. But it is this glorious temple that God is building. It is a spiritual house. It all started with the first living stone. But now we are all living stones. And we have a purpose. Verse 5, what is our purpose? What is our purpose in verse 5? Yeah. Would you say that's a pretty important purpose? We are being built up for a royal or a holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. And although Peter does not focus really on the rejection of God's people in these verses, I think really in the context, the greater context of 1 Peter, it's that suffering of God's people that's always in the background. If we are so important to God, why are we suffering? Why are we having to undergo persecution? Why does God let people reject us? It all starts with the living stone, who himself was rejected. We as living stones, the parallel with Jesus then and implied in the greater context of 1 Peter. We are suffering as Christians. Jesus was important to God too. But guess what? He suffered as well. But in spite of the rejection of man, Jesus was accepted by God. Man may reject you, but he still accepts you as to be part of this amazing building. And he accepts your worship. In fact, that seems to be this focus of the last portion of this section, where he focuses in verse 7 on what happens to those who disbelieve. In verse 7, he says the precious value then is for those who believe, but for those who disbelieve, the stone which the builders rejected, this became the very cornerstone, a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. What happens to those who disbelieve, who reject the stone? They're going to be destroyed. For they stumble because of they are disobedient to the word. And to this doom they are also appointed. For people like them, God has already appointed this doom. But you're not like that. Instead, in verse 9, God has a royal purpose for you. If those who are disobedient are appointed to doom because of their disobedience, what about us? In verse 9. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of Him who called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. For you were once not a people, but now you are the people of God. And you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. I think it's important to see that several of these, that all of these verses, or verse 9 and 10, the description that we have of us now as Christians, where are these coming from? It's coming from the Old Testament. From looking with me in Exodus chapter 19. In Exodus chapter 19. And in the context of Exodus, the people have been brought out of the land of what? Out of the land of Egypt. They're being brought to where? They're going to go to Canaan eventually, but in Exodus chapter 19, they're going to Mount Sinai. At Mount Sinai. And there at Mount Sinai, they're going to meet somebody really important. They're going to meet God Himself. And so in all of this, it says in chapter 19, starting in verse 1, "In the third month after the sons of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, and on that very day they came to the wilderness of Sinai. When they set out from Rephidim, they came to the wilderness of Sinai and camped in the wilderness, and there Israel camped in front of the mountain. Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, 'Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings,'" what a wonderful description, "'and brought you out to myself. Now then, if you will obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, among all the, and for all the earth is mine. And you shall become a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak to the sons of Israel.'" So here is the great I Am coming to meet this nation who have just recently been really pagans, and they're in Egypt, and He's bringing them out. "You've seen what I've done to Egypt. You see the great power that I have. But I'm going to treat you differently. You're going to have a special purpose. You're going to be my own possession." What does that mean for the people of Israel to be His own possession? What's that idea? Okay. And as opposed to, you know, the thinking about all the nations of the world, He has chosen, this is a chosen nation. It's that through Abraham, your seed will be a great nation. I'm choosing this nation. But it's not just that He builds up this nation. He says, this is my nation. In other words, you can translate this as my special treasure. And it's not just the people that God has to drag around, and although I'm sure sometimes with the Israelites he did feel this way, you know, annoyed at the people of Israel. "Why do I have to drag this people around?" He is calling them to be His special treasure. That yes, we in this relationship with God, who is the one that benefits most? Well, the people of Israel, His people. But in this description, God says, "I benefit from this as well. You are my treasure. You are my inheritance. You are my people." What an amazing thought. That this people could do something that pleases God. But not only is He going to be we're going to be His special people, for all the earth is mine. All the earth is mine, but you are my special possession. You'll also be a kingdom of priests. A holy nation. What does it mean to be a kingdom of priests? Now there's going to be a priesthood among the Israelites, the children, the sons of Aaron. There's going to be the Levites, who are special among the Israelites. But even in this verse, who's He talking about? He's talking about the whole nation is going to be a kingdom of priests. In what way? How are they going to serve as priests, as a kingdom of priests? Anybody have an idea? What was God's goal? Even looking at the plagues of Egypt, what was God's goal? in showing Egypt who was boss.
To have all the people know that God is Lord.
Yeah. Yeah.
We need to obey his commands and precepts differently from the main things of Egypt, thereby offer up sacrifices.
Yeah. And so it's to show his glory to all the nations, isn't it? And when you get to Canaan, that's exactly what happens. You have the people of Jericho. They're just shaking in their boots. Their hearts have melted, it says, because of their fear. They've heard what has happened. But God wanted the world to know who he was through this people. They were going to be a kingdom of priests. Priests, yes, they have priests for themselves, but they would be a kingdom of priests for the entire world as well. That people would come to know the great I am through this people. That's a pretty amazing thing that God has called them to do, called them to be. And also he says, you're going to be a holy nation. You're going to be different from all the other nations. You're going to be my nation. You're going to be separated. Well, what's amazing when you get to 1 Peter is that when we read these verses in 1 Peter, who is he talking to? He's not talking to Jews. He's talking to people who are Gentiles. He says, now God has chosen you to be priests. God has chosen now you to be a holy nation. God has chosen you to be his chosen possession. It's not anymore about, it's not about circumcision anymore. It's not being a child of Abraham anymore. It's about being the people of God, being part of God's family. He also quotes Hosea chapter 1. If I can find the text real quickly, we'll read that text. But in Hosea chapter 1, there's just some interesting dialogue that goes on here. If you remember the story of Hosea, where Hosea is required to go and get a wife of harlotry, and he's going to have children of that wife of harlotry, and he's going to name these children some very specific names. In chapter 1 of Hosea chapter 1 and verse 6, it says, starting in verse 3, so I went and took Gomer, the child of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore a son. The Lord said to him, name him Jezreel, for yet a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the bloodshed of Jezreel, and I will put an end to that kingdom of the house of Israel. And on this day I will break the bow of Israel with the valley of Jezreel. And so he names him Jezreel, but with a particular purpose, because it's going to be not only the name of his child, but also it's going to be a prophetic message about how God is going to break the bow of Jehu, the king, during this time. But then in verse 6, it also says that she conceived again and gave birth to a daughter. And the Lord said to him, you shall name her Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer have compassion on the house of Israel, for I would ever forgive them. But I will have compassion on the house of Judah and deliver them by the Lord their God, and will not deliver them by bow, sword, battle, horses, or horsemen. And then also in verse 8, and then she weaned Lo-Ruhamah, and she conceived and gave birth to a son. And she said, and the Lord said, name him Lo-Ami, for you are not my people, and I am not your God. And so it talks about each one of these individuals that is named by Hosea, each of these children of Hosea, given specific names, and these names are given for what? Well, they're messages about how God feels about his people, about Israel himself. And so specifically, talking about Lo-Ruhamah, and then also talking about Lo-Ami, there are these names that are specific. I have no compassion on you. It's It's a horrible name to give to your children. Don't give your children that name. Or also, Lo-Ami, you are not my people. Because you're rejecting you completely. It's not a very nice name to give to your child, but there are these prophetic names. But then there's also a prophecy attached to them that one day there would be another nation that I will take in as my people. There would be a nation that I will take in as and show compassion. And so when you get over to 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 10, all of this is as he's saying, this is all fulfilled in whom? In us as Christians. For you once were not a people, but now you are the people of God. You had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy or compassion. So all of this is playing on these prophecies from the book of Hosea, saying that God has taken and rejected His own people. Why? Why did He reject Israel?
Their rebellion,
their idolatry. They were a holy nation, but what did they do? They rejected that purpose. They rejected their holiness. They rejected their reverence. And as a result, God rejected them as a people. You're not my people anymore. But now He turns the tables and He says, He's opening up His arms to us, a Gentile people of many different nations. He says, I'm opening up my doors. Now you are my special people. Now you are my royal priesthood. Now you have received mercy. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. What an amazing thing to think that God, who has worked with this creation, or has worked in this world in so many amazing ways that we read about in the Old Testament and read about in the New Testament, that now He has opened the doors for us who are unworthy to come and participate and taste the goodness of our God. I wonder, and when there's so many elements when we look at the church, when we look at the people of God in the New Testament, there's so many comparisons that we can make with the Old Testament as well. I think many of us are familiar with some of those comparisons. But I wonder if in this chapter as well, there's an element of superiority. While the Old Testament was made up of stones, this new temple is made up of what?
People,
living stones. Not only have we received a living hope, something that will last, not only have we received it from a living word, a word that abides forever, from a living stone that has resurrected from the dead, we are living stones. We will last forever in this temple that will not be destroyed by man. But we are being called to a special duty, to a special purpose, and being accepted by God. It says in verse 5 that we are being called to do what? To offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God. In verse 9, we are called as living stones to do what? So that we might proclaim the excellencies of Him who has called us out of darkness into His marvelous light. And it's we who are now lights of the world and have this purpose of calling out, proclaiming His excellencies. And it is we, in verse 12, who are called to a specific purpose, a special purpose. And what is that? To keep our behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they might, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. That through our working as priests in this world, our God is glorified. We announce to the world the glories of God. And as a result, it seems in verse 12, we bring others to His glory. And in the day of visitation, they too are living stones. We have an amazing purpose. We have a huge job to do. What does this mean for us? I think number one, we need to think about us as living stones. Each one of us, a priest of Yahweh. Don't think about yourself as, well, my job is I'm a construction worker. I work hacking into computers. Hey, I'm a garbage man, or you know, whatever it might be your profession. Do you realize who you are? What God has chosen you to be. Well, that is true. Number one, get thankful. Be thankful for what He has done for you. Be thankful that even though I am a Gentile, not part of this chosen race of the Old Testament, I am nobody. But God has allowed me to become a priest of God. And if that's true, I need to get holy. How were the priests treated in the Old Testament? You remember some of the laws that these priests had? They were not even allowed to touch the dead bodies. They were not allowed to marry. They were not allowed to go into the temple if there's some defect in their bodies. No, only the most holy individuals will come before the great I Am. You need to realize what God has chosen us to be. And as a result, we need to be holy as He is holy. We need to be thankful. We need to get holy. And also we need to get busy. Because we have a huge job to do. Because there are so many people in this world who have not heard about the excellencies of our great God, who need to hear it from my mouth, who need to see it from my character, who need to experience it with my actions. The job that I have to do as the great, as a priest to the great I Am, is too important for me to become distracted by my suffering and my pain. It's too important for us to be distracted by the things that are unholy in this world. It's too important for us to be thoughtless about being a Christian. God demands everything from us. We need to give Him everything. Because of who He has made us to be. The salvation that God has given to us as Christians is too great to let myself be distracted. It is a salvation that is it's indescribable. We have a new life that God has brought us to. Why would we put that new life to the side? Why would we let holiness and reverence and love be tarnished by the sinful things of this life? And we have a purpose that God has called us to. Let us rise up as the priests of God and give Him the glory that He deserves and bring to Him all the glory of this world. Thank you so much for your kind attention. And God be praised.